Hi, everyone. It's really great to be here. I apologize in advance. I'm losing my voice a bit because I'm halfway through a six-week book tour to promote my two books. So I thought that I'll chat for about 20 to 25 minutes on what we're doing. And then mostly I want to hear from you guys. So we'll open it up to questions after that. So hopefully I can answer everyone's questions. And thank you for allowing me the shameless self-promotion of putting my two books out on the table. So, hi, I'm Randi Zuckerberg. I graduated from Harvard in 2003. The only reason I mention that is because I have another sibling who did not graduate. Thank you. So that's kind of my, twist sibling rivalry, twist the knife in a little. Also, I want to apologize. Anyone who was in the other session that I did earlier, there might be a teeny bit of overlap of content, but I'll try to keep it all fresh. So after I graduated from school, most of the people in my class already had jobs upon graduation because everyone my year wanted to work for McKinsey and Goldman Sachs, and I was like a creative person, which they did not have a clue what to do with at Harvard. But I graduated, and luckily soon after, I found a job at Ogilvy & Mather Advertising Agency in Manhattan. They were starting their entry-level program the next week, so I was very lucky. And I had all these visions of grandeur, of showing up and working on glamorous television sets and magazine ads. And I wound up getting staffed on a brand new team called Digital and Interactive Marketing, and I called my mom and cried. But it worked out because 2 years later, all my friends were still getting coffee on television sets, and Digital Interactive was the fastest growing area inside of Ogilvy. And it was around that time that I started getting phone calls and emails and IMs from my brother talking about this little project that he was starting called the Facebook, and he could really use someone who understood digital marketing. Translation, he wanted someone who would work for free. And I was his sister, so would I go along with the plan? And of course, I dutifully told him no. No way. I loved my life in Manhattan. There was no way that I was leaving. I was 22 in the city. There was no way I was moving out to the suburbs of California to work for my brother's stupid little project. So I held out for a few months, and he slowly but surely he started to wear me down. The thing that ultimately got me was he offered to buy me a JetBlue ticket to fly out to California. At 22, I was very easily bribed. So I went out to California and was just really blown away by what I saw out there. It was a handful of young men just coding, so passionate about what they were building. They really believed, even from those really early days, that they were building something that was going to transform and change the world. And there was one moment in that weekend that really did it for me. They were having a meeting about like what the brand would look like, just like thinking about the design and the colors. And all the guys turned to me and they were like, "Okay, Randi, you're the marketing person, you pick." And I was like, me pick? It would take me 10 years at Ogilvy to even get into a room where they were saying, "You pick." And that was when I really caught the entrepreneurial bug myself. I thought to myself, gosh, I don't know if this company is going to be successful. I sure hope it's going to be. I sure think it's going to be, but I don't know if it is. But what I do know is that the responsibility that I'm going to get working for myself, working for a small company, is going to help me bypass so many years of my career climbing the corporate ladder. And that was what really did it for me. Now, the only real wrench in my plans was that I was dating a wonderful guy in New York who had just given up his dream job in California to be with me. Yikes. So that was a really fun conversation to have, to come back and say, "Hey, you just gave up your dream job in California. Well, I'm moving to California." I'm really happy to say that we are married now and everything worked out. And actually, we talk about it. It took us maybe like a year to stop being so sore about it. But after that, he says, one of the things that he really respected about me was that as a woman, I think so many women just value themselves by the relationships that they're in. They don't really put their own ambitions, their own dreams first. And he said that that was something he really admired. And he was like, I could really see you being a good role model for our children one day, like putting that your own ambitions first like that. So just my word of advice to every woman in this room is to like really follow your dreams, because the men in your life or the partners in your life support you more than you may even think. So then I embarked on my journey at Facebook. 6 years there, I really led some exciting, some crazy, some amazing projects while I was there. One of the biggest eye-opening moments was pretty early on when I started. It was right after there was a very tragic shooting at Virginia Tech University. At that point, we had almost every college student in America was on Facebook. And I remember that we all gathered the staff into one room saying, like, what should we do? How should we respond to this? By the time we got out of that meeting, almost everyone on Facebook had already changed their profile photo to a black ribbon in support of Virginia Tech. We didn't tell them to do that. It was just people, human compassion, and using this platform to mobilize on their own. I think that was the moment that I realized, gosh, Facebook is so much more than a dating site for college kids to poke one another. although it was mostly that at the time. But it could be so much more. It could really be an instrument to bring about great change in the world. So that's when I started getting really focused on politics, on global politics, and how Facebook could really change the game in that level. I worked with President Obama and John McCain's campaign in 2008. I worked on the midterm elections that happened all around the country. I even worked in elections in Iran, in the UK, in areas all around the world where there were different challenges and different issues in each country. And it was really quite incredible to see the impact and the different challenges brought to light using social media. So for everyone in the room, I think there were three things that we did really well in the beginning of Facebook, mostly by accident, but some of them on purpose that we can all learn from. The first was we took a demand-led marketing approach. We didn't just open Facebook to everyone on day one. A lot of sites do choose to open to everyone on day one, but I think some of the most successful rollouts that I've seen you start with a small group of people, and then you slowly roll out so you make your product feel a bit exclusive or scarce, and you wait for demand to build up before you launch. So we launched originally at Harvard, and then we waited until enough students at Yale emailed us asking for Facebook. Then we opened at Yale. So we knew that Facebook was going to be a success there even before we opened it there. So I think that's definitely something I would recommend to anyone who's about to launch their own online platform. The second thing we did is we learned really quickly that we had a passionate user base that would work for us essentially for free. And what I mean by that is we realized we had some real scaling challenges. We very quickly needed Facebook to be in over 70 languages in the world. We didn't have the resources for that. We were a small team. We hadn't raised that much funding. It was going to be very expensive and take us months to do that on our own. But one engineer had a really great idea. He thought, gosh, I bet a lot of our users are fluent in all of these languages. What if we just allowed our user base to translate for us? Within 48 hours, the entire site had been translated into Spanish and French. So again, that was a real learning for us, that we had this passionate user base that was just dying to be given things to do to help out. And I think for all of us in our businesses, there are probably ways that you can leverage your passionate customers even more than you're already doing in order to help you with marketing, help you with business challenges, help you with any areas that you might be lacking in your own business. The third thing is that we really thought very hard about company culture. It seemed silly at the time because we were so small to think about, you know, what our culture should look like. But it turned out to be very important because a lot of the companies in Silicon Valley, they'd start off really cool. All the engineers wanted to work for them. And then they would grow really big, and suddenly they weren't cool anymore, and all the good talent would vanish. So we thought, how do we stay cool even when we're a multi-thousand-person company? And we thought the real way to stay cool was to make everyone in the company feel like their voice mattered, that it wasn't just a hierarchy with a few people at the top making decisions. So the first thing we did was every month we did a hackathon, which is not going to sound very fun to you guys, but you have to trust me. You stay up all night, and you can only work on a passion project. You can't work on anything related to your day job. It has to be just something in your heart that you've always wanted to work on. So you spend the whole night staying up, drinking lots and lots of Red Bull, and in the morning, everyone gets up on a stage like this, presents their idea to everyone in the company, people vote, and then the best ones actually would become features on the site. So imagine being an intern or someone who just started working at the company a few weeks ago, and your project is chosen to be visible to a billion people on Facebook. There's not that many companies that would allow someone new to have that privilege. So don't get me wrong, though. Most of the projects were very silly. There was one engineer who said, gosh, I love Facebook and I love beer. Like, how do I manage these? How do I mesh these two passions of mine? And he actually built a keg that when you tap it, it takes a photo and uploads to Facebook what you're drinking. So, of course, everyone in the company had to take one for the team and go test the keg that night. We were, like, only being responsible citizens. A few of the designers went up to the roof and drew a life-size QR code on the roof of the building that you could actually, like, if you fly over the headquarters, you can actually scan it with your phone, and it actually works. So, but other people did all sorts of, like, fun, zany, crazy things. And it was actually during one of those hackathons that I came up with a project that actually led me to start my own company beyond Facebook. So what I had been spending a lot of time, as I mentioned, I was working very heavily on elections and global politics. And I thought, you know, gosh, what would CNN or one of these news sites look like if it was done entirely on Facebook? Could you have a live news channel that's just entirely through social media? And I decided, you know, well, I'm going to make a Facebook news channel. I'm going to call it Facebook Live, and I'm going to, like, interview all of our engineers, and it's going to be live on the site. It'll be like my own mini CNN. And I started taking engineers into this little room. I turned a broom closet into a little makeshift studio and just started interviewing everyone and didn't really think much of it. I didn't even last the whole night staying awake, so I didn't even get to present it at the company the next morning. I was never good at the all-nighters. About 2 weeks later, though, I got a call from one of the biggest talent agencies in Hollywood saying, Katy Perry would like to come on your Facebook show. Shit. I was like, I need to actually pretend that this is, like, a legit show, that it wasn't just a passion project I threw together in a broom closet. So I was like, you know what? Like, these opportunities, they don't come every day. So, like, I'm going to fake it till I make it. Like, if it kills me, I'm going to host Katy Perry on my Facebook TV show. So sure enough, hosted Katy Perry. It actually went really well. She had a great time. She announced her North American tour. It sold out in minutes. And before I knew it, like, every celebrity was coming up to Facebook to be on my Facebook Live show. So it was about 6 months after I launched that initial show that I got a call from the White House. I thought I was being punked. I was like, who gets a call from the White House besides Jack Bauer? Like, I don't know, no one. And they said, you know, President Obama, his approval ratings are very low right now. He wants to know if he can come on your Facebook show and talk to all of America in a town hall. So that was really something. We had 2 weeks to throw together an entire town hall for the president, and I go into all of the crazy, crazy details about that in the first chapter of my book opens up on what it was like planning this, meeting the president, getting MC Hammer into the room at the last minute. That is a whole other story. All I knew from that moment, I thought, gosh, you know, if I've achieved this much success in 6 months doing this show, surely if I could expand beyond just Facebook, if I could use other social media platforms, there's a really huge opportunity out here. And so that actually led to me having a really emotional conversation with my brother where I told him that I felt it was time to leave Facebook. He was very understanding, and I told him I wanted to start my own company. But I actually had two startups because about 4 days after the president came, I had my son, Asher. Asher arrived 4 weeks early in my life. I think I was just like so stressed out from hosting the president that he was like, time to escape this crazy stressed out woman. And having Asher really made me rethink a lot of my priorities around technology. I saw suddenly, I started to notice all around me people in restaurants buried in their cell phones and people at concerts watching an entire concert through a phone. And I just started noticing all these things about our society. And I just realized, like, gosh, like, first, A, I'm a little bit responsible for this. But B, is this the relationship with tech that I want my son to have? And if it's not, I need to start changing that right now. So that led me to start thinking, researching, working on Doc Complicated. I realized that I had a very, very complicated relationship with technology. I came to Silicon Valley as an outsider. It's very hard to be taken seriously in Silicon Valley if you're not an engineer, and B, if you're a woman. And two, I had had 6 years leading all of these really high-profile projects, hosting the president, doing all of these things. But on the other hand, I still felt like I wasn't taken seriously because I had the last name Zuckerberg, and people always thought I got where I was because of nepotism. And so I realized, you know, I have a very complicated relationship with technology, but as a mom, it's a complicated relationship that I think most of us in this room can probably relate to. Tech makes our lives amazing in so many ways. It's because of this tech that I can be on a 6-week-long book tour and still be connected to my family. But on the other hand, almost daily, this same tech makes me want to rip my hair out of my head. And I thought, there's all of these tech books that are written either like for super geeky geeks or just like super dumbed down. But where's the book for all of us? Where's the book for all of us who are like way more tech savvy than we give ourselves credit for and are just trying to navigate our lives, our children, our work, dating, all of these crazy things that have changed in the wired world? So I went to HarperCollins and told them I wanted to write this book. They were very receptive, and I said, but wait, there's more. I also really want to write a children's book. I had, again, seen my son firsthand. He's 2 years old now, but he's already so adept at navigating technology. It's scary. And one day I was tucking him in for a nap, and he started going tweet, 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 tweet. And I was like, he's not talking about Twitter. He's 2 years old. Like, why was Twitter the first thing that I thought about? And I realized there's all of these words in our lives that have kind of been taken over by tech, but that have beautiful, beautiful meanings out in the real world. So in Dot, which is my children's picture book, in the beginning of the book, Dot swipes and taps and touches and tweets. And in the second half of the book, when she's outside swiping, she's making a finger mural. And tapping, she's dancing. And tweeting, she's singing with the birds. So it's just a reminder for children and adults that there's a beautiful world when you look up from your device. So I'm really excited to be here talking to all of you guys today. Again, on the road for 6 weeks. We just found out that Doc Complicated was ranked New York Times best-selling book, which was really, really exciting. Thank you. And we've started to grow Dot Complicated not only as a book, but also as a web community. So we're inviting anyone to submit their Dot Complicated stories. I know all of us have a Dot Complicated moment or 20. So we're inviting people to submit their stories, give advice to one another, and really make it a community to help navigate this wired world together. So I'm very thankful. And with that, I'd love to open it up to questions. I guess maybe is the best way for people to gather at microphones or, okay.
Is that how we're doing? Right here? Yeah. Okay. Randy, thank you so much. I'm with Dell, but one thing I wanted to thank you first, and then I did have a question. But earlier in the conversation for the roundtable earlier, I really appreciate you and the other speaker giving a thumbs up to people that are over the age of 40.
Yeah.
Because I'm 50, and I am an extremely active Facebook user. And
wonderful.
I know you guys said, you know, someone questioned the statistics of how to reach people over the age of 40, and I'm definitely a testimony that it can be done. But I also wanted to let you know that using Facebook, heartwarming stories that when my father was dying of Alzheimer's, I was able to communicate with him. Because memory recognition, photo recognition of your family and loved ones, and music and prayer and that type of thing by using my Dell computer, of course, must say that. My Dell technology, of course. I was able to communicate with my father long distances, and my brothers in the Air Force in Guam. And up until the day my dad died, he recognized my brother on photos that were on Facebook. So.
Beautiful
I love Facebook
story.
For that reason. So,
that's
and
beautiful.
Now I'm an ambassador
Thank
for
you.
The Alzheimer's Association. So anybody, go to the Alzheimer's Association and utilize your technology because that's the way to get to older people for memory recognition. It definitely research shows it does help them. So my question is, within Dell, we have different ways that we mentor young people, and I'm a mentor for one of our endeavors, which is called the Dell Social Innovation Challenge. And I love working with college students, but the problem that I have, and it's a good problem, but I have to say problem because it's an issue, is that after I mentor them, they want to stay connected with me, and then after the event, I get a million requests on my Facebook to be my friend. And although that's a great thing, I also use it, again, for all these personal reasons. What do you recommend? Do you recommend that I want to keep it on Facebook because they're not quite used to LinkedIn yet.
Yep.
Do I start a separate group within my Facebook? And then what, isn't there a security risk, like you had said in the talk earlier, that, you know, somebody could take a photo and share it that way? Or do you think I should just start a totally separate Facebook page for myself?
It's interesting. I think if this is a closed group around a certain specific topic, I think it could be a great idea to start either a Facebook group or a group on another platform where you can tell people, you know, come join this group, give me your email address, I'll invite you in, and that's where we're having all of our correspondence around mentoring. I'm glad you mentioned LinkedIn, though, because I have found LinkedIn that you get incredible engagement on a lot of especially content that you post. So, and I think more young people are becoming savvy around LinkedIn also, so I feel like I might drive them to either connect with you there or join you in a private group. If I can elaborate on one thing you mentioned that was before, that was really great. I often see a lot of people who talk about like all children should stay off technology. Like they shouldn't be on it. It's horrible. It's going to ruin their lives. And I'm glad you mentioned your beautiful story about Alzheimer's because I think there are some. The glass is very half full with children using technology. I think that in one hand, children are gaining incredibly valuable skills. They're becoming excellent storytellers in a way that we were never taught when we were younger. They're developing beautiful visual and graphic skills with all of these new platforms that are out there. They have the opportunity to keep in touch with relatives. I know I basically lost touch with my grandparents when they moved to Florida and we were still in New York, but because we didn't have things like Skype and Facebook. So I always encourage, you know, of course, yes, there are a lot of risks, there are a lot of challenges, but there's also, I think, some really incredible advantages to young people using technology.
What do you think of Snapchat?
That's a whole other ballgame, Snapchat. So I've actually, I was like almost completely negative on Snapchat until one mom told me how she uses it, which is actually pretty great. She said when her daughter arrives at a play date, she Snapchats her so that the mom can see in the background that she actually is where she says she is. And she was like, that works perfectly. We don't even need to exchange words, just like a Snapchat photo. And then it's like total trust.
Do you find it safe, though?
I think...
As far as where do the images go?
I think that's it's fun. I think it's a fun platform. I think... teenagers are always looking for ways to like talk in code, to communicate outside the adults, to go a little rogue. Where I think it gets dangerous is when people are texting like nude photos of their body and inappropriate things, because it's way too easy for someone to screenshot something. So I think it's really the responsibility of all of us as parents and of educators to have very frank discussions with our children about those possibilities.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hi. My daughter just graduated in August with a video game design degree from Austin Community College. And right now the gaming industry is kind of changing up. A lot of the bigger players are kind of downsizing. A lot of independents are growing around. Do you have any ideas on advice on what direction she should head for I mean, networking's great and everything, sure. But she hasn't really connected here in Austin.
Well, first of all, awesome to have a woman going into gaming and engineering.
And actually, I think she was like the only one in the program, too, being female. And
I'm sure.
I wanted to see if I could get your brother's phone number.
Amazing. One avenue that I would really encourage her to think a little bit about, if she's willing to think outside of the box, is about health. Because a lot of health companies are applying game mechanics to health. So there's, you know, you have like Fitbits and a lot of just interesting things in that space. There's like fun new kinds of alarm clocks and new ways to track weight loss and health goals and running goals and all sorts of things. I think that's a really great, exciting area for anyone who has a background in gaming.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Hi. I want to get your thoughts on a concern I have.
Sure.
I'm very connected. I'm on everything. And I came from years at WebEx, so I'm virtual. But I'm from the Valley, Silicon Valley, and I work for a large high-tech company there on Tasman. And we're all leaving the office now, so they're closing down all their buildings, all the lettered buildings on Tasman.
Wow.
And we're working virtual. So I don't work with anyone in person. I've never met my manager for 2 years, never seen her, don't know who she is. And I've been interviewing people for positions in our group that I will never see. And I have an issue with all that.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about virtualization?
On one hand, I think it's amazing for women to be able to have the flexibility in their lives of working from home and working virtually. I know for me that's been a game changer in my own life. One thing that I have seen, though, is the rise of co-working spaces. I know especially in the area that I live, there's a lot of people who feel what you feel. They like the flexibility of their own hours and working from where they want, but they miss like talking to people at a water cooler or having coffee and saying hi. So what they'll do is they'll just rent a desk in a co-working space. And even if you're going in there every day or half a day or 2 days a week and doing your own things, you're still surrounded by a lot of people, which can give you kind of the camaraderie of other folks. So I know that's really, really popular, especially with a lot of women who really enjoy having that camaraderie, but also value their flexibility. So I might encourage you to look into a few of those. It won't help you maybe meeting your own team and your own colleagues, but at least it'll give you the feeling of working around other people.
I have that option, but do you think not working with your own team in person, does it affect the outcome of work? I mean, what are your thoughts?
It's interesting.
That?
I think so. One of the research studies that we did in the group, because I always get asked, like, should you Facebook friend your boss or Facebook friend your colleagues, is that Facebook friending that your team actually makes you more likable to your team and more productive because people feel like they know you and they get along with you. So I wonder if maybe there's other ways like that to get to know your team, like through like either friending them on social networks or starting your own private like group chat or even just like extending them an email that you'd like to get to know them? Could you have a Skype? Or I think just little things like that go a long way, and probably no one has reached out to them and asked them, so they'd probably be really thrilled and really grateful for that.
Thanks.
Okay, there's probably several people that have this question in here. So I now have a 13-year-old as of about a week ago, and I love that she loves Instagram and she has an iPhone and, you know, I love that she makes video stars, things like that. But now I'm finding that I need to find creative ways to help her unplug. And so there's probably a lot of great ideas in this room, but you know, instead of just saying, I've tried the whole, you know, after 8:30 p.m., you need to put your iPhone away, and that doesn't necessarily work. So she's not on Facebook yet, but she does Snapchat with her friends and things like that. So, and my other two kids, you know, they're not as accessible to technology yet because they're younger. But I was just wondering if you have thoughts on that of, you know, kind of making it
I've a certainly
more
spoken to a lot of parents, so I'm definitely still very new on this, having only a 2-year-old, but I can empathize with everything. One of the things that that a lot of people have mentioned to me that seems to work well is giving almost like a digital allowance every week, either in addition to or instead of a monetary allowance. So saying, you know, you have like X many minutes or X many hours to use these services. So allocate them however you want. You could spend all of Saturday on Instagram if you want, but then like you've used up all of your time. And in order to get more time, you need to do things that are outside or do other things. That seems to work well because it puts them, they're part of the solution instead of just like telling them no, no, no. When in doubt, though, there is an Apple router you can buy that kills the Wi-Fi in your house after a certain hour of the night. And if you need to go to even more extreme measures, there's actually a cell phone prison that you can buy on eBay or Amazon where you put everyone's devices in there, and no matter what, they do not come out for the allotted time that you put in. So whether you want to use soft measures or hard measures, there are a lot of things in between. But I was signing some books earlier today, and a lovely woman came up to me and she was like, I had a great idea for my family. I told them we were going to go on a vacation and no one was going to bring their phones. And she's like, and then my household broke into chaos and mutiny. And so I think, you know, you probably have a bit of an uphill battle ahead of you, but at least if it starts with things like no phones at dinner time, or for this 4-hour block on the weekend, we're going to all unplug as a family. I think little by little, people will start to value that time. But I know it's really hard with a 13-year-old. You're like, you have to pry this phone out of my cold, dead hands.
And I have a small comment and then a question. First of all, to those of us over 50, I'd like to thank you and your brother and your teams for making birthdays so much more special that we're able to sit and look for hours. Oh, they like me. They really like me. They didn't forget me. So thank you for making birthdays special, more special than ever. As a kind of a follow-up to the discussion just then, my passion in my community that I do my volunteer work is our Child Advocacy Center.
Right.
And we hear so many more stories now about children, young adolescents that are lured because of what the images and what they think are on Facebook. And I know Facebook is not the only outlet for that. Timing just happens to be right. And I know parental monitoring and other things come into play. But do you see technology, and including Facebook, playing a bigger role as the needs go farther in helping children, even if it's a banner or a sidebar, I'm probably not using the right terminology, that reminds our young people, especially our young ladies and young men, that the images that they see and the communications that they are making may not be what they actually appear. So it's just a reminder that maybe that 13-year-old boy is really a 40-year-old man that's trying to lure
I think a lot of the tech companies have banded together recently. They work with the Ad Council, and they run a lot of PSAs on everything from catfishing is kind of the word for that, to like don't text and drive. So every month, all the tech companies band together and do that. For me, one of the things that I talk a lot about in my book is I'm very anti-anonymity on the web. I know that that's kind of a far viewpoint for a lot of people, but I find that on sites where you can be anonymous and have a pseudonym, there's much more hatred, much more bullying, much more behavior like what you're talking about. And on sites that make an effort to verify and encourage your real identity, people are much more thoughtful in what they post or much less likely to pose as someone else. So kind of one of the best examples that I can give of that, you have like Craigslist on one complete side of the spectrum, anonymity. And on the other side of the spectrum, there's a new site called Nextdoor. I don't know if anyone really knows. And in my neighborhood, I've listed a few things on Nextdoor. And every single time I've listed them, not only have I gotten like thank you notes, but someone left a $10 Starbucks card. Someone baked a pie because there's like a thought that you might run into these people again, that you know them, that you are who you say you are. So I talk a lot about that, but I think one of the first steps towards protecting children online is going to be making big steps towards ending anonymity online.
That's an excellent point. And perhaps as you plan your next dot children's book, that maybe along the lines of bullying
I think that's an excellent idea, and I've already thought that dot, one of the things that Dot would be very passionate about is spreading the message around cyberbullying.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And thank you for what you've done for everybody through Facebook.
Thank you.
Thank you again. My name's Marisa. I'm a student at ACC right now, and I'm also very avid on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, social media. And one of the questions I often like kind of run into or think about with social media is like, since I'm like kind of thinking about my career and like coming to conferences like this, meeting very influential people, is how important is our like face on social media? How many followers we have? Like how much value does our social media profile really hold? I've seen things about like your resume being replaced by your Twitter, your resume being replaced by your social media profile. And I've just been kind of thinking about that and just want to hear your thoughts on those views and everything.
It's a great, great question and very mature for your age. So thank you. I think when kind of in the birth of social media, everyone, there's this mad rush to have as many friends and followers as you could have. It was like anyone you met, friend them and try to get as million Twitter followers. I think now social media is growing up with us a bit, and the emphasis is now more on quality, having maybe fewer friends but higher quality friends, or not all of those million Twitter followers, or most of them are robots. So, like, what's the, you know, maybe having 5,000 really engaged Twitter followers is better than having a million bots. And the other thing that I would encourage you, though, is instead of thinking about each site individually, think about your entire presence as like your entire online reputation. Because probably the first thing someone's going to do when they meet you is probably not go to your Twitter, not go to your Instagram, not go to your Facebook. They're going to Google you probably. And they're going to see what comes up on the first page. And so just by nature of having a Twitter, having an Instagram, having a Facebook, all of those things come up on the first page. They're ranked very highly. And so you're controlling what people see about you rather than like letting articles or what your friends write say about you. So even if for no other reason than just to control your own online reputation, it's good to have all of those accounts and make sure that you're putting your best foot forward there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Madi Bell Garcia-Valls, and I'm a mama entrepreneur of the Culture Coach. I'm an executive coach. And so an executive coach helps people get to their growth, helps people become successful through their personal life and professional life. And so my goal this year and my experiment was on my Facebook page was to get so many likes by January 1st. Just to show that positivity, and if you ask for something and then you believe in it and then you let go, it'll happen. But there's also some work that I have to do too. So my goal is to get this for free, you know, get likes for free. And I guess my question is, one, how do we do that for free? And two, are there other new media sites that can help entrepreneurs like myself grow?
First of all, congratulations on your business. That's really, really exciting and well needed. I think there's definitely lots of great things that you can do even on a very none or limited budget. I think one of the other things you can do is you can find some like-minded businesses or other folks in the same area as you and cross-promote with them. So maybe offer like either some kind of a discount if someone's a customer or something else and bring people to you that way. I also think the more that you can view yourself, like view your Facebook page, like what value are you providing to someone who likes your page? Because people have gotten savvier. They're not just, they used to just like everything. Now people don't anymore. You have to really provide them with a value. Maybe that value is you're very funny and you're going to entertain them. Or maybe that value is you're posting like beautiful images and inspirational quotes. Or maybe you're giving little tips of executive coaching, but obviously they'd have to work with you to get the whole thing. I would just think, you know, what value are you providing them? Because nothing's truly free. Mm-hmm. And, If you're not going to spend money on advertising, which, you know, I think it's great to get likes organically, there's definitely going to have to be some kind of push and pull, and that's probably on content is going to be your best way to get it.
So do you think that, and I've heard that Facebook does have great marketing and they can target, do you think it'd be worth investing a little bit of money to market through Facebook?
I think especially for a business like yours where you're focusing on like high net worth or folk individuals or people on the C-suite of a company, I might explore both like the hyper-targeting on Facebook and hyper-targeting on LinkedIn.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Amanda. I work for a company called MakerSquare, awesome. And we teach people how to become web developers, and we actually want a lot of women to get involved in the field.
Wonderful.
So I'm not technical, and what you said earlier kind of resonated when you went to Silicon Valley, and you're like, I'm like the non-technical person on the team. So can you tell me a little bit, this is for myself personally, how you broke into that and got people to outside of your company to take you seriously and get up to speed with everything?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was definitely a journey. It doesn't happen overnight. You have to really build it over time. But I think eventually, because I was doing so much work with television networks, all of the engineers started to kind of take notice and be like, oh, Randy works on the fun things. And if we want to be on television or like get tickets to a taping of SNL or something, like we have to be friends with Randy. Oh, maybe she has some value. And so it kind of started like that. And then also, I think as women, we are really afraid to like self-promote or like say what we're good at, but men are really, really good at doing that. And so I think it's all about if you do have a success, if you do have a career, either not being afraid to like pitch that to a blogger or to the press, your own success, or having a friend pitch it on your behalf. Because eventually, I think that was what worked for me was that other like tech blogs and different things started taking notice like, oh, this really exciting election partnership that Randy led and other things like that. Although I had been very, very, very bad about advertising my own successes. So I always tell women to like, be really bold about advertising your own successes because a man in your shoes would not think twice about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michelle. I have a question for you. So there's a lot, like you said, there's Facebook, LinkedIn, I have my personal email, I have my work email, I have text messaging, and I don't even think about Twitter or Instagram. It's too much. So how do you...
It's like a full-time job.
Yeah. I mean, then if you join any sites or anything like that, it's like another inbox. So obviously technology, one of its main roles is to help with productivity, but I find a lot of times that it does the opposite, where I feel like constantly distracted by messages or a million places to look. You spend so long responding to emails that I either feel like I mean, sometimes it takes away productivity, and sometimes I just shut it down,
yep.
and then I feel like it's – I don't respond to people right away, and people expect that immediate response nowadays. So mm-hmm. how do you – like, what's the best – or what are your thoughts on kind of, like, finding the best balance?
Yeah,
there?
So it's funny. I refer to it as productivity porn because there's, like, all these apps that are, like, will make your life more productive, better communication, all this stuff. But you're, like, no, it's just another app you want me to use. Like, that is productivity porn there. And what I found is that, again, it's like a slow but sure thing. So one of the things is in my family is we're not that religious, even though we're Jewish, but I like to observe like digital Shabbat, even though we don't do like that much like regular Shabbat. And what I found was that like when I started doing that, people would email me on a Friday night, and if they didn't get a response, they'd email me again on like Saturday night or Sunday, like, hey, did you miss this? But I kept being very adamant, like, sorry, I don't like email on Saturdays, or I don't do Instagram, I don't do Facebook, like I don't do that. And little by little over time, because I respected my own time, other people started to respect my time. And it's not going to happen overnight, but eventually, like, you'll train the people around you that you value your time, and so they should value it too.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. It's a really pleasure to talk to you. If you were too shy to ask me a question, Facebook, tweet, anything. I'll also be, it's like a 5-mile hike from here, but I will be signing books back in the exhibit hall. So I'd love to sign a book for any of you and answer any questions there. So thank you so much.